Thomas Fast will not meet next week. Next week is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. There will be no meeting of the class that week. Okay?
Will we be meeting the first day of Hanukkah or the second day of Hanukkah?
When is the first day of Hanukkah? What's the date?
21st.
No. There will not be a class then. So any Hanukkah festivities would have to precede Hanukkah. Okay. We are at the top of page 282 in the English. We are aware of the fact that there are three different sized courts. We have been dealing so far with a court of three and different types of cases that would be brought before the court of three. And we continue with that. Smichat zekeinim ve'arifat egla bishlosha. The smicha of the elders and the decapitation of the calf is done by three judges. Divrei Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda omer b'chamisha. Rabbi Yehuda says five judges. Okay? Now, we already have seen last time that we are going through a summary of a wide variety of different areas of the law. And here we are going from the more common areas of law, which we discussed last week, which were monetary issues or damages against a person's body. We're going now into areas which are clearly referred to by Scripture, but are peculiar to Scripture, such as smichat zekeinim. Now, smichat zekeinim does not mean what it seems to mean. The smicha, I explained to you earlier that smicha is an ordination, and that one of the things that we're going to have to keep in mind, and will come up very early on in the Gemara, is who are these judges? What does it take to be a judge? How much professional knowledge does a judge need? Does a judge need more than that? For example, does a judge have to have a level of appointment? Or can anybody who knows become a judge? So that's going to be something we'll get to when we get to the Gemara. There is a level of smichat zekeinim, which means the appointment of the judges. When we talk about smichat rabbanim, that is the way we would say the ordination of rabbis. Smichat zekeinim could be similar, and there is an ordination of zekeinim. But that's not what's being referred to here. Here we are referring to what is spoken of in the text in the fourth chapter of the book of Leviticus. And there, in the early chapters of Leviticus, there are a number of sacrificial procedures that are described. This is all part of Parshat Vayikra. And toward the end of that is an interesting case where it says, "Ve'im kol adat Yisrael yishku." If the entire community of Israel does wrong. And what that means is, if a court, and a court meaning here a court that rules to teach how it is that the law is to be observed, and the court rules in a certain way, and it turns out that the court rules in a mistaken way, okay, then the entire community has done wrong, but they have done wrong not because they knew they were doing wrong, but they have done wrong unwittingly because of the erring of the court itself. In that case, if it is the whole community of Israel that has erred, just as I've said, and the matter escapes the notice of the congregation. Congregation means here Eda. Eda means the court. Right? If the court shall have erred, and we don't know what court it's referring to, but it's referring to something that the court has erred. so that they do any of the things which by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done. That is to say, the people unwittingly err because of the decision of the court, and they realize their guilt. That is to say, the court later realizes that it has ruled wrongly. Okay, the court comes to that conclusion. When the sin through which they incurred guilt becomes known, the congregation shall offer a bull of the herd as a sin offering. It is a ritual procedure. Because on the one hand, what the court has to do is it has to reverse its ruling. Okay, so it reverses its ruling. But in the meantime, people have done wrongly. So in the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, if you have done wrongly, even without intent, you have to bring an offering. Because you have still done wrongly, at least in the eyes of God, even though there was no intent. So there's a sense of guilt for even those things which were not necessarily meant. The congregation shall offer a bull of the herd as a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. Now read it to the next verse, 15 in Hebrew. Bisamchu ziknei ha'eda et yedehem al rosh hapar. And the elders of the community, of the eda, whatever eda means there, shall lean their hands upon the head of the bull. Before the Lord. Before the Lord is a technical term meaning in the temple precincts. Bishachat et par bifnei Hashem. And he shall, we don't know who that means, he shall slaughter the bull before the Lord. Ve'evia kohen ha-mashiach, and the anointed kohen, meaning the kohen gadol, the high priest, shall bring midam par from the blood of the bull, El Ohel Moed, to the tent of meeting. Vetavala kohen etzva'o min adam behizah shevet pamim lifnei Hashem, and he shall dip his finger into it and then scatter the blood seven times. It's a little bit like the offerings on Yom Kippur. You remember? Achat, achat b'yachat, shtayim, shtayim v'shtayim. During the Avodah service, there's a sprinkling. It goes one and one, one and one, and then two. Two and two, and so on. So that's the procedure. There is an atonement procedure, and that procedure comes, but intermediate to the atonement procedure is a laying on of the hands by ziknei ha'eda, the elders of the eda. That's what we're referring to here. Smichat zekenim, the laying on of the hands of the elders, in this case, is done by a court of three. Now, we don't know whether that means that there are three elders. Probably not. Probably you have three, a court of three, and one person lays on the hands. One person's representative of the court.
Or one by one.
It's not clear from the text. But what is clear, is, at least as far as the Mishnah goes, is that in this case, where it talks about zekenim, we're talking about three zekenim. Okay? And the decapitation of the calf is done by... Yes, sir?
About the zekenim, is that the same court that made the error and reversed it, or is it another court?
Well, it is zekenim min ha'eda. I was very cautious about translating the Eda, because I think what the Eda has two possible meanings. Either the Eda means what it means in English, the community, or Eda can also mean court. It can mean either one. So this probably, in the context, to answer your question, Zikneh Eda means three people from that court. Three people from the court. In the court, I assume that they're referring to here is the Sanhedrin, the greater Sanhedrin, which is the major court, the Supreme Court, as it were.
Because you don't have an appeal, you wonder how we'll ever determine that there was erroneous judgment.
No, that's true. That's true. You don't have an appeal process. Right? I wouldn't say you don't have an appeal. You don't have an appeal process. You have something of a process in that. Once a ruling is made, anyone can challenge that ruling. And the way you challenge it is simply to argue against the ruling.
Where?
within the court itself. You can always argue a case ad infinitum, which is one of the reasons why the Mishnah itself always contains minority opinions. Now, we will see that again and again. Rather than a Mishnah which contains only the decisions of the court, always contains minority opinions. Because that's the way the law functions. And a later court, either a later court, or even the same court, can come and it says, Gadol b'minyan u'b'chachma. Either the court can be of a greater number, so you're talking a smaller court has made one decision, the larger court has more power to gainsay the decision of the smaller court, so that's the minyan. Oh, but the real key one is the chokhmah. Chokhmah means simply they have a better argument. Okay, so an argument can always be presented in one form or another, but it doesn't have the clear procedure that we're used to in terms of an appellate kind of procedure.
Three points. One, on Yom Kippur we send Egel Azazel, and here we kill the
you send a goat, an Ez Azazel.
After we do similar scenario.
What?
So here the whole nation was in sin, and we let the goat go.
Mm-hmm.
And here, only small Eda or community had a sin, because of the goat, not even the goat.
Yeah, but it's an interesting, this is a different issue. When in the Yom Kippur atonement, the assumption is that everyone has sinned personally, that we have all sinned. Here, you have a special case. Here, the people sin because of the court itself, and that's the special case.
The second point is, they said here last week we discussed about matchilim b'shlosha v'lo gamru obrim l'chamisha l'shiva v'chule. I cannot see a court. Make a decision, we cannot make a decision, let's call two more people.
Wait with that, because we're just reading the Mishnah. When we get to the Gemara, we'll see, because so far, we can't understand why, to tell you the truth, we haven't even discussed why three.
Right.
Why three? Why not two? Why not one? Why not five? We have no basis on which to understand even the number three. We're just seeing this sort of survey exposition of the law at this stage of the game. We'll get to the Gemara.
And the 3 point, the three is Tkufat HaShoftim and even King Shlomo, all the judges were one person. All the courts were of one person.
Well, we don't know. So, Shoftim, the reality, when we talk about Shoftim, in Sefer Shoftim, in the Book of Judges, we're really talking about something else. We borrow
the people came in front of Dvorah Nevi'ah, and
nonetheless,
and King Solomon,
they had no doubt certain functions certain roles that they played. But those are roles that are frankly different from the roles that we're reading about here. Yeah, even though there's judgment, we are now reading about, in effect, the judges are a period of about, after Moses, so 900 B.C., this is 1,000 years later, 1,000 to 1,100 years later. So by somewhere in between that period of time, you have real formal courts. I mean, we see certain things in the Torah itself. Right. There are always were certain forms of judges. We're reading about the form of these judges in the second century when we're reading the Mishnah. I don't know. I don't really think that it's historically accurate to assume that everything we're reading in the Mishnah was exactly the same 1,000 years before. There was undoubtedly some development going on in the legal system. Even though there's no doubt about the fact, because of what you said, Bisharecha, that there was a legal system right from the start. It's very unlikely that there wasn't. But we can't assume that it was necessarily exactly the same, 1,000 years apart. All right.
Can you ask Milton about the case to be re-argued? Re-arguing the same court when no decision can be made. Is that when it goes to a 5 or a 23?
No, because the 5 and the 20, the 5 and the 23 are very specific areas of the law. But and there's got to be a reason why it's got to be 5, And there's got to be a reason why it's 23.
So it can be argued endlessly who makes the final decision.
And it is. It's always argued endlessly. We're still arguing it. Because that's the nature of this thing. It is endless. It is basically endless. You can always make a decision. And you have to act on the decision of the court in your day. But there's no certainty that that's correct.
Would you think that each and every time that is a recognition that there is an incorrect decision, that they would go through this process?
That's what it appears to say. Whether it actually happened that way, I couldn't tell you. But that's what it appears to say, yes. Okay? Yes?
So how do we reconcile the opportunity for unending arguments with the concept that what a rabbi says in a response is definitive?
Mm-hmm. It's definitive until the next response. In all truth, it is. It's fully definitive, and it has to do also with the area of his authority, because there are two issues here. One is some abstract notion of what's right. The other is the person who rendered the decision may have certain authority within a community. Which is not to say that authority extends to the entire community. For authority to extend to an entire community requires an odd set of circumstances, because there is no legal procedure by which the community actually functions in order to have a top authority. It appears in the Mishnah that they are talking about such a community. I'm not sure it's very realistic even in their time. We talked about that last week. But let's say in our own time, who was telling me the other day, we have a problem here in New York. It's a very practical problem. It's a problem of the Eruv in New York and its impact on the housing market of the Lower East Side. A very interesting issue. Things that you don't normally think about. I talk with colleagues about this, and it's fascinating to see. Manhattan has an Eruv. An Eruv means that the area, a geographical area, is a contiguous entity to the extent that people can carry in it. One of the most important ramifications of the laws of Eruv has to do with little children. Because children can be driven in a stroller in an area with an Eruv, but not in an area without an Eruv. Okay? So this is practically a really big problem that you try to solve in a community by an Eruv. That is one of the reasons why many of us believe it is crucial for a Jewish community to create the Eruv. The rabbis on the west side did it. Rabbis on the east side joined with the rabbis on the west side. All of that has been done. So we have an Eruv now. You can walk from the East River to the Hudson River on 86th Street, and you can roll a baby carriage. Okay? Because it's the Eruv. You're all within the Eruv. The Lower East Side. The Eruv does not extend to the Lower East Side. Why? Because Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was one of the great halachic decisors through the 50s, he died, when I was in rabbinical school, he was still alive. He must have died around 1970 or so. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein wrote several books of responsa called Igrot Moshe. Literally the letters of Moses, of Moshe. And that's his name, Moshe. He decided that he did not approve of a Jewish community having an Eruv for a variety of reasons. One of the main reasons why certain rabbis have rejected the idea of the Eruv is because people get used to having an Eruv, and then when they travel in America, they assume that other places have an Eruv. They adapt their lifestyle to the presence of the Eruv, and the Eruv is really only practical where there is a large Jewish community that's an observant Jewish community that can affect an Eruv. So Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Feinstein rejected the Eruv, and to this day, because of his stature, no rabbinic authority in Manhattan challenges the fact that the Lower East Side does not have a valid Eruv. Lower East Side, that's in deference to Reb Moshe. That's in deference. What happened over the last 25 years is that the housing stock in the Lower East Side, on one hand, there's some very good lower middle class housing stock there. And there's a real tradition of the Jewish community living there. But the Orthodox community today, the young Orthodox, the modern Orthodox community today, essentially will not live in neighborhoods without an Eruv. Because people want to have families, they want to be able to... Women, it's partly a result of women wanting to go to the synagogue. Realize there was a time when women did not go to the synagogue. It was just not an issue. They didn't have any, you know, it wasn't expected that they would go. Now women want to go to the synagogue. These women have children. And children become an issue. So the women, because of the modern world, the women and the children, in fact, have a much more effective place in the decision-making of the community. So the modern Orthodox community did not want to go to the Lower East Side because Rav Moshe forbade the Eruv. As a result, the Chinese moved in. And in fact, that housing stock is now largely an overflow from Chinatown. What the Jewish community, the organized Jewish community, is trying to do is to get people to move to the Lower East Side because it has certain historic roots in the Jewish community and it has a decent housing stock for young families. The problem is there is no Eruv. So either you have to get people who are yuppies who don't care about this whole issue, but they really have no great attraction to the Lower East Side. It's people who have a greater attraction, people sort of coming out of the modern Orthodox yeshivas, who really might go down there. So the question is, can't you change this? Well, the problem is, Reb Moshe was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Tiferet Yisrael on East Broadway. His son took over after him. And the son would never make a ruling against the father. So here, I'm just giving you this example. We have a practical example with which we're living here in Manhattan, which actually affects Jewish demography in Manhattan. And it's all a result of somebody who had such respect in the community that no authority wants to go against what he said. Although, at the same time, the whole rest of Manhattan goes against what he said. Because all the other rabbis in Manhattan don't agree. So we're actually functioning at two different levels now, but in deference to this one rabbi, the Lower East Side still has the issues of the Lower East Side. So that's the way it is.
Just a comment, if I may. I knew a Hebrew teacher some years back who lived in Borough Park. Her husband was a Borough Park resident when they got married. When she had a young child of three, she wasn't permitted to go out and walk on Shabbos holding his hand.
Correct. It's a big problem. The laws of Erevin and of children of the problem of children. I don't want to get into that, but it is an issue. It really is an issue in the law, and the whole thing can be dealt with. I had a colleague who was in Lakewood, New Jersey, conservative rabbi in Lakewood, New Jersey. He had all kinds of problems with the Lakewood Yeshiva there. And one of the main problems, he invited me once. I was the guest rabbi. I was a guest scholar. I was a scholar for the weekend. So I went to Lakewood, New Jersey, and he was explaining to me the local issues. The biggest local issue is the Eruv, because they will not allow an Eruv in Lakewood, New Jersey. They will not allow it. And basically, it's in order to make sure the women don't go to synagogue. to Lakewood, the issue was women. Because they felt that women who went to the synagogue would end up having contact with other people in the community. They would have to get to the synagogue from wherever they lived. And the fact that they had contact with people in the community would lead to the assimilation of the women. And they would then have ideas that were dangerous ideas. So to make sure that that didn't happen, for the same reason they wouldn't allow a pizza parlor. They had no pizza parlor downtown in Lakewood. They told me the problems of the pizza parlor. The pizza parlor, they wouldn't allow, because once they have a pizza parlor, people will hang out there. And they didn't want to encourage anyone to hang out. So there was no place to go. So he was just describing to me the dynamics of this particular community. So, I mean, these are facts on the ground, and these are not necessarily complete, you know, they're not lunatics. I mean, these are odd realities in the Jewish community. And I was talking with a guy today. Any of you at the Minyan this morning?
Yes.
Who was here in the morning? You saw that a fellow came in to see me this morning? Zechabadnik, a very smart guy. Very, you're going to wait, this guy's going to be a very important person in the Jewish community. What? He's an educator. This guy's an educator. It's Rabbi Schnur. He's an educator, and what he is doing is trying to revolutionize Haredi education. Ultra-Orthodox education. He feels that the main problem in the ultra-Orthodox world is that there was no professionalization of education. No one has studied education. And if people wouldn't learn about how to educate properly, the whole ultra-Orthodox world would become a lot more civil and would function within the world in general. He sees the whole thing as a problem of education. So you have a very... So we got in our conversation just to the ultimate impact of that, because in the non-Orthodox world, the general impression of all of that is they're a bunch of nuts. What difference does it make? They're machinists. Reality is that this is going to change very shortly. It's in process of change right now, and it will change dramatically within the next two generations. For a very simple reason. It's demographics. They have 12 children, and we have 2. Barry, you can tell me how long it takes.
Not long.
To shift the whole balance, but that balance is going to shift, and the whole reality of the Jewish community is going to change. It's going to change simply because of that fact. Simply because of that fact. Nothing to do with what makes sense or what we think is right or wrong. Nothing to do with that. Simply has to do with the sociological and demographic realities. So these are things that... You know, we're sort of in the process right now. To get back to where we were. The decapitation of the calf. Decapitation of the calf. Okay? That is referring to... Deuteronomy 21:4. If in the land that your Lord your God is assigning you to possess... Someone slain is found lying in the open. Right? You find a dead body. And a dead body is out in, not in any city, but is between the cities. The identity of the slayer is not known. Your elders and magistrates shall go out and measure the distances from the corpse to the nearby towns. Yatzu zikkeinecha v'shoftecha. Okay? Now, in truth, I don't know exactly what it's referring to, but it uses the two key terms. Zikkeinim and shoftim. Okay? Elders and judges. And they shall go out, umadadu et el ha'arim. And they shall measure to the cities, sevivotech alav, around the slain person. Right? And whichever city the person is closest to, the judges then of that city have to go through a ritual, and it's a ritual decapitation of an animal, and that is all part of an atonement city, an atonement, in which case the judges of that city also have to say, that's the Mishnah, not here but elsewhere, the judges have to say, we were not responsible for spilling this man's blood. The Gemara then says, how could you have ever thought that the judges were responsible? What it means, therefore, is that the judges say that our city protected people from wickedness, from murderers, and therefore we were exercising the proper authority that we had as a court, in that we were we safeguarded the individuals who would come and go in our city. And so that was a fascinating idea here, that public authority has responsibility and has to exercise that responsibility. And if somebody dies, somebody is slain, public authority has a level of guilt in it. The other possibility also that is referred to in the Gemara is that when they say that we did not spill this blood, what it means is that we did not, that we were able to make sure that people were not so hungry, that people had to, people would develop the practice of murdering, because simply, you know, having a super poor population can lead to problems like that. So it's a very interesting idea. But again, the first thing that we read about in the Torah is the measuring, to which city the person's body is closest. That, it says here, is done by the three. That's Divrei Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Bachamisha. Rabbi Yehuda says five. Now, I remind you that when I read this to you, it said, Zekenecha b'shoftecha, both. And we didn't know what that meant. Why would it say both of them? Well, here you see immediately that there's a disagreement among the rabbis. One says three, which is what we've been used to now when we see the phrase, Zekenecha, your elders, and the other one says five. So, maybe it has something to do with that. We'll see. Okay, questions? Yes. No, that's not unusual. Yes, I'm sorry, it is unusual.
Are offerings decapitated?
No, they're not decapitated. It's offering is shechita. Shechita is the severing of the jugular vein in the windpipe. That's all it is. Here, this is unusual. This is a rare instance. I think it's the only instance of decapitating the animal. Correct. Correct. Next, Hachalitza v'hamiyunim v'shlosha. Chalitza and refusal are presided over by three judges. Now, one is Chalitza, the law of Chalitza. The law of Chalitza is such, and we talk about it even to this day, even though today Chalitza is mandatory. Chalitza is mandatory. In the Torah, if a man dies, a man is married to a woman, he dies without leaving any issue. Right? No children. Okay, no children. Correct? It's the story of Ruth. It's the story of Ruth. So he dies without leaving any issue. According to the Torah, and this is the issue in the book of Ruth, the man's brother is required to marry the woman, and then any issue produced are produced under the name of the original husband. Okay? So in other words, he has an heir. The original husband then has an heir. But he has an heir produced by his brother. By his brother. If the man says, I refuse to marry her, the assumption here in the Torah and in the rabbinic literature is that the woman wants this to happen. She wants it. She wants it. The reality apparently is that she wants it, but he may not want it. Okay? He may not want it. So if he doesn't want it, then the procedure of chalitza takes place. Chalitza is a case where he removes a shoe and she spits in his face in order to publicly embarrass him. Okay? Because he will not take upon himself the responsibility of a brother. Now, the procedure of chalitza over time, in fact, the chalitza is still done. When I was a seminary student, we used to be witnesses as a betin at the chalitza. It was done periodically. Chalitza today is mandatory. It is now, ever since the 10th century, it has become prohibited for a man to marry his brother's wife. It's prohibited. It's prohibited. The rabbis later prohibited it because the problem was, it was possible only in a society where you had polygamy. Because the man could have one wife and he would now take a second wife. Right? He would, in effect, sire a son for his brother, his dead brother. So chalitza still is with us. Chalitza requires the procedures to be done before a court of three. Okay, the procedures are done with the brother-in-law and the woman, but it's in the presence of the court of three. Ni'un is a slightly different case. Ni'un is a weird case. This is, the Torah apparently gives a father the right to marry off a minor daughter. Father has the right to marry off a minor daughter. All these things become prohibited at a later stage of the game. The father has a right to marry off the minor daughter.
Minor meaning under
13? It's not clear. Well, certainly not 13. It might be 12, but it might even be less. Okay? Could be 11. So not clear. So the father has that right to marry off a minor daughter. What if the father dies? The Torah gives him that right. If the father dies, the mother wanted to be able to do the same thing. Right? Essentially, it must have been some kind of an economic arrangement. Families were often worried about their daughters. They were, because of the nature of the society, the non-productive and the productive, fertilely productive, ideally, but not monetarily productive. So the men were monetarily productive and wanted to bring more men into the family. So the mother, the widow now, would perhaps want to do the same thing. The rabbis eventually give her the right. They eventually give the right also to her older brothers. It's a family type of thing. However, the problem is that the Torah does not give them that right. The rabbis decide, whatever the nature of family structure was, to provide that right even though the man has died. Because the Torah does not give any other member of the family the right, the rabbis decide that the girl herself has the right to refuse. She has a right of refusal. Because you can't institute anything like that. It's just too bizarre a procedure to institute if the Torah doesn't institute it. That's called niyun. Niyun. Niyun is a case where she says, I don't want to get married to this guy. Okay? She can say that. She has a right to do it. It has to be done before a court of three. Okay? Excuse me?
What's the consequence?
If she does it that way, no consequence. She's free of him.
She can then in society contract for another marriage?
Correct. Correct. And she's free?
Yes.
Correct. She's perfectly free to do it under the law. Correct. Yes. And it's a respect. It's respected. There's no reflection on her.
So it's only if the father is dead. If the father it's only is the alive, father. The girl doesn't have the right to refuse?
Correct. Because the Torah gives the father the right to make that decision.
So, our court accept an idea of a girl under the age of 12. She is not legally adult. So, how if she above 12, then there is no.
That's correct. When she becomes of age, she has the right to refuse. She can refuse when she's 5, but they can't do anything with her.
The father usually.
The father, if the father makes that decision, it's a decision.
earlier than 12.
Earlier than 12, correct. At a certain point, yes, she has her own right. Correct. It's got to be before 12. Correct.
So how the court will accept El No as a valid argument? She's underage.
It doesn't matter. She has that right. Because the Torah did not give anyone else in the family the right other than the father. Because of that fact...
She by default get this... suddenly she's an adult and her opinion is...
It is correct. In this area, her opinion is valid. Correct. Her opinion is a valid opinion. Now, realize, I think what is functioning here, the whole thing's bizarre. I mean, you can't imagine this is a functioning system. I mean, it would only function a very... I understand. I mean, I read... This doesn't happen in Jewish life. It hasn't happened in Jewish life, I'm sure, probably 2,000 years. It does function in certain societies, Indian society. I've read about the way in which this, in many of these other societies, this is the way things are dealt with. And the girls in the family are, in effect, sold off, in effect, to be productive in order to get income-producing from the husbands. So you did have something like this in the Torah. As I said, it thankfully goes out of practice. But this resultant thing of the biyun, it's called miyun, and that's in the case only where the father is died. No, none of it. I mean, in theory, it's in effect, but it's not practiced. You can't do any of these things. No, I have never heard. Correct. Well, chalitza has to be in effect. Because you don't, the rabbis forbade women to marry their brothers-in-law. Yes. They forbade that to happen. The only way you could forbid it was to say, you've got to give her chalitza. You must have chalitza. So chalitza is not a problem. I mean, chalitza is simply a procedure that you have to go through and that they force you to go through because they don't want to allow for the possibility that the brother-in-law would marry the sister-in-law.
Right.
Okay?
When it was in effect...
What if he was single at the time? In theory, he could do it. No, actually, no, that's not true. No, I take it back. Because the Torah itself, the odd thing about the levirate marriage is that is a marriage that the Torah forbids. And it is only permitted in this odd case. Right? Only permitted in this odd case. Otherwise, it's a forbidden marriage.
No, I mean, a man dies. You're saying the rule of the Takana because of polygamy is such that the man's
It becomes universally... The rabbis universalized
it. So that it wouldn't be polygamy.
Now, the reason that they wanted to get rid of it entirely was that it was against what would otherwise normally be prohibited by the Torah, which was the marriage between a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law. So as long as they were getting rid of part of it, they got rid of the whole thing. Okay? Correct. It would be Gilui Arayot. Correct.
Okay. In your situation, it
doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You read the Torah in the 20th chapter, in the 19th and the 20th chapters of Exodus are all the Gilui Ariot, and they're not necessarily blood relations. They are also relations of marriage. They're marriage relations. Okay? Okay. And we are too involved in these things. You see what's going on here, by the way. Very quickly, we are getting a survey of the law. In the first Mishnah of Masechet Sanhedrin, we have this incredibly long Mishnah, which is taking us through a survey of monetary law, of torts. Now we've been in family law. Let's see where we go from here. Okay, look what's next. Neta revai umaser sheni she'en damav yudu'in bishlosha. Neta revai. The fourth year plantings and the second tithe, whose price is unknown, is determined by a court of three. And we're moving to an entirely different area of the law. We're moving to agricultural area of the law. Okay? Exactly. The agricultural area of the law is, if you plant a fruit tree in the land of Israel, it's true to this day, it's the law in the land of Israel. If you plant a fruit tree in the land of Israel, during the first 3 years, you are not allowed to touch that fruit. I mean, you're not allowed to make use of the fruit. The fourth year, you have to take the fruit to Jerusalem and bring it as an offering. In the fifth year, you can harvest the fruit. Okay? So the produce of the fruit tree in the fourth year is called netarivai. Netarivai. Right? The planting of the fourth. That has to be brought to Jerusalem. Well, what happens if you live far from Jerusalem? If you live far from Jerusalem, exactly the same procedure can be followed as in the law of the second tithe, Maaser Sheni. Now I'll make a change. Go to the Maaser Sheni. If you're a farmer in the land of Israel, you have to give 10% of your crop to the Levites. That's called Maaser Rishon, the first tithe. Right? Then in years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the 7-year cycle, remember this is a 7-year cycle, the 7th year the land has to lie fallow. So in years 1, 2, 4, and 5, you have to bring a second tithe, and that second tithe has to be brought to Jerusalem, and you have to eat the food in Jerusalem. Okay? That's called Maaser Sheni, the second tithe. Obviously was there in order to stimulate travel to Jerusalem and the business of Jerusalem, the hotel business in Jerusalem. As I always say, we read this the last time, those of you who were in the synagogue on Shemini Atzeret, we read the portion of the Torah that says this, and as I say every year, the law is either you do that, or, if you're in the Galilee, then you can sell your produce, you can sell the produce, you take the money, and you have to then go to the King David Hotel in Jerusalem and spend it. You have to spend your money in Jerusalem. That's the idea. Okay? How do you know how much the produce is worth? We have two cases here. We have a case of netarivai. Also, the fourth year, you have to bring it to Jerusalem. You don't want to do it, you can cash it in. You can cash it in. How much is it actually worth? The court, in fact, is involved in assessing how much it's worth. Well, there are two possibilities here. One is that the court simply wants, if you are going to do something that is obviously designed as a part of the ritual law, that in fact you will not skimp in your ritual expenses, but in fact you'll in fact pay what you should be paying. Okay? Now in fact the Torah, as far as the Maaser Sheni, gives you the general parameters, and then you have to pay 5% above it. You have to pay that additional 5%. That applies also to the fourth year, to the netarivai, plantings of the fourth year. Realize what this says, though. It says, netarivai Maaser Sheni she'en damav yedu in bishlosha. What we do not know is how to read this Mishnah. We don't know whether the Mishnah is referring to both of those categories, she'en damav yeduin. What could be referred to here is that in each of these cases, the produce itself putrefied. It went bad. So let's say you didn't do this soon enough. You know, with produce, you can't just let it stay around. It's a tremendous, it's a burden. But if you let it stay around, and let's say, you know, after a week, it begins to spoil, then its price goes way down. So at that point, you're in effect dealing with very little money. So if you're going to cash it in on your own, it's really in your own interest to let it spoil, right? Because it's going to cost you money. It's going to cost you money. You let the thing spoil. So if you've got to take money from your pocket, you'd rather pay one shekel than five shekels. Well, three quarters of it is spoiled, then it's only worth one shekel, because that's what it's worth on the open market. Okay? What the Mishnah is trying to protect against is such a procedure. Namely, what the court decides, even if the produce is spoiled, is what the produce would have been worth before it had spoiled. Okay? Because, in effect, what the Torah wants you to do is to take the money and to spend it, to take your own money and to spend it, and to spend it well in Jerusalem. Okay? And you shouldn't skimp on those kinds of expenditures.
I want to make sure that I understood. So, for the first 3 years, I cannot have the fruit of my tree.
Correct.
But I can give on the first and the second year my ser sheni from that tree.
No. No, that tree, nothing can be done with that tree. Maser Sheni is from your other produce.
Yeah, but Maser Sheni comes from the first year of the produce and the second year of the produce and the fourth year.
No.
So it's the same tree and it's not the same produce.
It's correct. It's not the same produce. Okay. We're talking about two totally different things. Okay. One has no connection to the other, in fact.
Okay.
We're just talking about the cycle of 7 years.
Right. Okay.
Year 1, year 2, year 4, and year 5, in that cycle, is a time when you give second tithe, from whatever is permissible to tithe. In fact, that tree is not permissible.
I want you to make sure that it's not the same.
No, it's not the same thing. Two totally different things.
It's just, Bob, it's reminding me of a semi-modern equivalent. When we didn't have a lot of spare money, we would buy Israel bonds, and when you would go to Israel, you were allowed to cash in the bonds in Israel before their maturity date.
That's correct. That's right.
And then we would spend all the money in Israel.
Same idea. Exactly. The whole idea was to encourage you not to spend your money here.
Right.
But better to spend your money there, even if you would do it, you know, you'd get the full value of it there.
Yeah.
You'd get the full value, exactly. If you cash in here, you would not get the full value. That's right.
You're not allowed to cash in.
You're right. It's great. It's great. Okay, next. Hekdeshot bishlosha. Here's another case. A man decides that he's going to give a gift to the temple. All right, he's going to give a sheep to the temple. Or he's going to give a car to the temple. The truth is, maybe sheep are useful to the temple. Horses are not particularly useful.
Unless the temple has land.
As what?
Land.
Correct. But even land is a problem for the temple. You know why? Because if the guy lives up in the Galilee and he says, I'm giving my land to the temple. You know what the temple would prefer? Cash. Right? It's the same thing. We have this issue in the shul. People give us stock. Some of you have been in this beautiful position of giving your congregation a gift of stock. You know what we do with the stock? Standard procedure in every synagogue. You sell it the day you get it. You sell it the day you get it. Okay? Because the truth is, we don't want stock. We want cash. The nature of the voluntary institution is that the voluntary institution wants cash, and it doesn't want to deal with the fluctuation of valuations that, in effect, most objects, including stock, really go through. So we deal in cash, and we try to change everything into cash. Now, here, when you give a gift to the temple, it's in the temple's interest to turn it into cash. May also be in your interest to get the thing back. I mean, you may have given a gift, you know, and you just as soon have the thing back, and, you know, it's your horse. And you invested a certain amount in this horse, your children love the horse, and so on. So you give it to the temple, but you really want to give the temple money. Question is, how much is the horse worth? Okay? That's an appraised valuation. And who are the appraisers? The judges. That's another job of judges. Judges are the ones who create the appraised value of a variety of things that need to be valued. Either crops or gifts to the sacred space, all those things have to be valued. And the Gemara, you will see, will say that it's very important for judges to do it, lest somebody inexperienced does the assessment, and it ends up that the sacred place then gets less than it should be getting. Because you always want not only a fair market value, but you want to be sure that the temple is getting everything that it should get.
I think last year or the year before we studied that if you give a gift to the temple and then you want it back, you need to pay 10% or something more extra.
Correct.
Now, are the judges checking the value of that too?
Well, whatever it is going to be a percentage. So, yeah, whatever the law is, whatever the law is, you're going to add a percentage penalty. That's the case of Temura is where you substitute something. In those cases, it's simply a percentage that's on top of it. But they're going to give a basic assessed value.
They will give assessed value
without the 10%. Then you add 10% to that.
Okay, so it's not the value that I gave him, it's the value that they will judge the value.
Okay, exactly. Yes.
Today, normally, at least I think the skill a judge has is to make a decision between two litigants, maybe more than two, but you have adversaries fighting it out, and the judge is supposed to decide the skills that you want to have for a judge, or the person who has knowledge of the law, but also judgment, and to try and figure out what's the right decision. So here, some of the disputes are in that way typical, like the name of a note, I think. But the skills required to assess the value of a piece of land or the value of a horse are not what we would typically associate with the skills of a judge.
Exactly. But it could be the judge's responsibility to direct somebody.
Could be, but you can see in this context, this is part of the multiple expertise that, in fact, judges are responsible for.
Now, judge has to do that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's true. You do have certain types of judges who would specialize in those kinds of decisions. You might have them. No?
No, because the bankruptcy judge also has parties taking different positions. The judge doesn't say...
There's a case of excise where they had to...
But who makes the decision? The expert?
No, the judge is
making the judge will ultimately make the decision. Here, it appears that the judge is both the expert and the decisor. That's correct. That's not the same thing. That is somewhat different. Mm-hmm. Okay? Let's keep going. I want to be sure we get through all of these. Now, Rabbi Yehuda said... No, I'm sorry. The next one is... Ha'arachim ha-mitaltalim b'shlosha. Erech values. Erech values is an area of a law where you say, I want to give a gift to the temple. And you're inexplicit about the amount that you want to give. But the value is associated with an object. Well, it's not exactly clear what that means. Again, in order to protect the income of the temple, we make sure that it has an expert evaluation. The appraised value is an appropriate appraised value. That's what is meant by arachim. The arachim of movable objects are appraised by three. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Echad Me'em Kohen. One of them has to be a Kohen. V'hakarka'ot tish'a v'kohen. And land, again, land that will be in the possession of the temple, where the temple is where it may have been given to the temple, but the giver, as well as the temple, want to turn it into cash. That is Tisha, nine judges, the Kohen, and the Kohen. So here, apparently, the number is 10, and one of them has to be a Kohen.
Is there a reason that this is the only place we've seen an even number of people?
Well, yes, there is. We haven't seen an even number directly, because the number that we see is 9. Okay? Then we see, and it's going to be a problem, whether one of these people has to be a Kohen, or whether you add a Kohen. You can be sure that wherever an issue like this is raised, it's raised not because of any issue of theory, but because of the text of the Torah. So in each of these cases, we'll have to see what the Torah is saying and why there is a problem in interpreting the text. Okay? The in kayotze, and likewise a person, the adam kayotze behem, and likewise a person must be appraised by 9 and a kohen. Now that is completely incomprehensible in the Mishnah, because as far as we know, there is no way that a person is ever, you can't give a person to the Kohen, to the temple.
But if there is somebody who stole something and he needs to pay money back and he doesn't have, so he may become a slave to the temple.
Nope, we don't have that. Nope.
So what you're putting in prison, that's not
really. The truth is, we don't know what it's talking about. The Mishnah doesn't know what it's talking. Well, the Mishnah is saying it, but the Gemara will immediately, when we get to the Gemara on this, the Gemara will say, this is an impossible case.
What about the last person?
What?
Could it be that Adam Petra...
You'll see. Don't worry about it. The Gemara is going to deal with it.
What about the case of Shmuel?
What do you mean, like Shmuel?
When... Wasn't he...
He is dedicated to temple service. Very nice. Could be. But in that case, he was a Kohen. Already he's a Kohen. So we don't really know what's meant by that, and whether that fits this. We'll have to see. All I'm saying to you is, we're reading the Mishnah. Remember, the Mishnah is usually, but not always, comprehensible. Moving on. All right. Now we're going to move, we have dealt with courts of 3, we've seen 5, we've seen 9, and we've seen possibly 10.
And 7,
correct. Okay? Dinei nefashot be'esrim u'shloshim. Now we are getting to a totally different area of law. Until now, we've been dealing with monetary law, with torts, and we've been dealing with ritual law. Okay? A variety of ritual law. And there's been a crossover. What?
The entirety of the things within those 3 categories?
Well, we're not sure. We don't know. We're going to have to ask that. The Gemara will have to ask that. It's a good question. Okay? Are these brought because they are examples, and there are other things that really are meant, but you don't have to bring all the details when you list things? Or are these exclusive? We don't know. You'll see the very first question of Gemara is going to be something along those lines. Dinei nefashot be'esri mishlasha. Now the question is, capital cases have to be dealt with a court of 23. All right, we're moving on now from the basic court of 3, with whatever additions it may have, to a completely different type of court, which is the court of 23. That is the court that deals with capital cases. Not all capital cases, but most capital cases. Now, the most common capital case is one of murder, but it's by no means the only one. Okay, because in the Torah, a lot of things can lead to the death penalty. Okay, we'll see some of them shortly. Dinei nefashot be'esrim u'shlosha. Haroveya v'hanirba ve'esrim u'shlosha. A beast that sodomizes a person, or a beast that is sodomized by a man, is judged by a court of 23. Now, this is probably one that the New York courts have not dealt with. Okay.
judges call litigants cows.
This is a particular relation to a cow.
Not quite a quarter of its peers, but...
Okay. It's a very odd situation. Look at this. Haroveya. Now, Roveya is where a male beast, okay, a bull, has a sexual relation with a woman, a human woman. Nirva...
That's mythology.
Right. Look. It's the satyrs and the Mennonites. It's incredible.
They've come out of a...
They've come alive.
Okay.
They've come out of a Greco...
The next one... Well, people... Wait a second. Let me tell you the next one, then I'll make a comment. The next one is where a man, a human man, has a sexual relation with a female animal. Okay? I am told that this is not only in mythology.
Correct. Today, if I may, there was a report in CBS Today and in the LA Times about men having cancer in the genital region in Brazil associated with bestiality.
Yeah. Bestiality is... All you got to do is put it into Google and you can get plenty of such things. Okay, even the CBS and the LA Times. And of course you're dealing with an agricultural society. I mean, where in fact you've got shepherds who are in the fields with their sheep, sleeping with their sheep, and you've got young men who are, you know, all kinds of things happen in this world. And such is the reality of life. Now, the Torah forbids all of that, okay? It's a prohibition of the Torah. So that, in a way, you can understand. It seems intuitive. That maybe is intuitive. Maybe. What is, I don't think, intuitive is that, well, maybe it's intuitive that the animal, if it's intuitive that it's a capital crime for a human being to do it, it's a real no-no. Okay? It's a real no-no. Maybe it's also intuitive that the animal, if the human being is going to get that level of punishment, that at least symbolically it seems the animal should be punished as well. What I don't think is at all intuitive is that the animal's case is brought before a court of 23. Okay, that I don't think is at all intuitive. The other ones I think might be intuitive. That one is not. Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember which destruction, whether it was Sodom and Gomorrah. No, it was the flood. Didn't all of the animals die in the flood because they were also...
Min shaloba mino, the Rashi says. They had relations beyond their specific species.
Right. So, but they were culpable. The animals were also...
That's a good point to make. Do have this notion of species specific sexual relations, and of course the mixing of species eventually is prohibited also by the Torah. Shadness. You know, there's a variety of types of shadness, from the mixing of linen and wool to other types of mixing of seeds, two types of seeds in the same field.
But to the loss of life because of sexual misconduct.
Correct, correct. By the animals. Correct.
Animals are held accountable.
Okay.
Is this a separate case than the capital case of the person?
Well, let's take a look. Leviticus 20:16. Let's read and see what this is talking about. Leviticus 20. Yeah. Not only is this Vayikra, 20:16. The 20th chapter of the book of Leviticus, the 19th and the 20th chapters of Leviticus are Parshat Kedoshim. That is one of the most famous of all the parshas of the Torah. Only thing is that hardly anybody pays attention to the second half of the parsha. First half of the parsha is famous for the things that it says. you shall fear, each person shall fear his mother and his father. You shall rise up before the old. A lot of very famous ethical ideas of the Torah go back to the 19th chapter of Leviticus. The first words of the chapter, you shall be holy because the Lord your God is holy. And follow a whole bunch of ethical ideas, but they are mixed in at the same time with rituals. Things having to do with very, very different aspects of the law. Comes the 20th chapter. The 20th chapter...
The psukim are here for people who have trouble from the inner...
Where? Oh, yes, you're right. If you want to follow in the on the Hebrew text. The Hebrew text. The 20th chapter of Exodus is the same as the 18th. The 18th chapter we read in Mincha of Yom Kippur. Mincha of Yom Kippur are the laws of forbidden sexual relations. And those laws are repeated in chapter 20. They're repeated in chapter 20. And I've always made the point that very basic to the Torah are chapter 18 and 20. They surround chapter 19. And everything that's in 19 really is surrounded by these two bookends of the sexual prohibitions in 18 and 20. They're very basic. Just the fact that it's all laid out that way makes me feel that these are very, very basic to the laws of the Torah. So in 20, let's see where we are. Verse 13. If a man lies, you know, that's homosexuality here. Man lies a woman, a mother's depravity, but in. Oh, here, verse 15. Chapter 20, verse 15. If a man has carnal relations with a beast, he shall be put to death, and you shall kill the beast. Okay? If a woman approaches any beast to mate with it, you shall kill the woman and the beast. They shall be put to death. Their blood guilt is upon them. Right? So far, that seems perfectly reasonable. I mean, as it were, if you can accept the basic premise here, I think it's intuitive. Now, look at the Mishnah. The Mishnah that we have seen so far has been pretty cut and dry. It just says, such and such is a court of three, such and such is a court of three, such and such is a court of five, and so on. It's been cut and dry. We haven't so far engaged in the quotation of verses from Scripture to prove a case. This is a little bit odd because we have said that the court of 23 is to put the animal to death. That's certainly not obvious from the scriptural text. So the rabbis have to prove it. Shenemar veharagta et ha'isha ve'et ha'behima, as it says, I just read it to, and you shall kill the woman and the animal, v'omer ve'et ha'behima ta'harogu, and the animal you shall kill. Now, that's his verse 15. That I read to you first. Verse 15. No, first it came 17 and then 15. Shor haniskal be'esrim u'shlosha. An ox that is to be stoned is judged by a court of 23. So now we have to figure out why we need a court of 23. All we know is that the animal can be killed. So we're going to go on to another slightly different case. An ox that is to be stoned is judged by a court of 23. Now, let's see, that's Exodus 21:29. This, hopefully you who have been in Baba Kama will remember this.
So what?
Exactly. When an ox gores a man or a woman, when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox is not to be punished. Okay? This is Shor She'eino Mu'ad. This is an ox that simply kills somebody for the first time. Okay?
First offender.
If, however, that ox has been in the habit of goring, that was the other case, and its owner, though warned, has failed to guard it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned. Interesting what follows. And its owner too shall be put to death. Okay? Wait a second. Pay attention here. Listen to what the next verse is. If ransom is laid upon him, the man, he must pay whatever is laid upon him to redeem his life. In other words, the guy can buy his way out of this. Well, the laws of capital punishment, that couldn't be. This is very odd. If a person gets the death penalty, then there's no way that the law could permit him to pay off the death penalty. The very nature of the death penalty is it doesn't require a payment of any kind. Okay? So, in a way, verse 30 seems to contradict verse 29. Because it gives the guy a way out. It's a basic problem in the Torah text here. So too, if it gores a minor, male or a female, shall be dealt with according to the same rule. Okay? So there's a real problem here in the text. Now, go back to what we have here. V'omer, eta behema taharagu. The behema, the animal that the man has the relation with, shall be killed. Shora niskal, when an ox is stoned, besrimu shlosha, that stoned ox, we learn, is judged in a court of 23. The one I just read to you now, the Baba Kama situation. I didn't say that just now, right? All right? Shinem, how do we know that it's to be judged by a court of 23? Hashor yisakel, the ox shall be stoned. The ox shall be stoned. The gam ba'alav yumat. The ox shall be stoned, and also its owner shall be put to death. The Torah, I'm reading the English now, the Torah juxtaposes the ox and its owner to teach not that in fact the owner should be put to death, but the ox is put to death the same way an owner might be put to death. How? By stoning and by the court of 23. So in other words, what the Talmud does is that the Talmud says when the text of the Torah doesn't make any sense here, when it appears that the guy can buy himself off, in fact, the man is not killed. You do not have a death penalty for this, or it's not an automatic death penalty anyway, but what the Torah means is to compare the case of the ox to the case of a man. And the cases are similar. How are they similar? Just as the case of a man can only be stoned with a court of 23, similarly the ox can be killed only with a court of 23. And because we learn that in the book of Exodus, it's also true every place we learn that the ox is to be killed, including in the case of the ox and the sodomized ox or the sodomizer ox. Okay? Now, as I said to my mind, that's not what I would call necessarily intuitive. But it is the way the rabbis understand it. And look what happens immediately. The Mishnah goes on and says, Hazeev v'ha'ari hadov v'hanamer v'habardales v'hanachash. It simply goes on beyond an ox to say a wolf, a lion, a bear, a leopard, a skunk, or a snake, in any of those cases where they kill a person, just as we are talking about in the earlier case in Exodus, where the ox gores, mitatan de esrim u'shlosha, they are wild animals. All right? They are wild animals. their death sentence is passed by a court of 23. So in all these cases, the animal can't be killed except by a court of 23. Now, it's a fascinating idea here. I won't speculate it, but until I read the next two opinions. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, Kol HaKodem LaHorgan Zacha. Whoever kills the animal first, it's fine. In other words, what are you doing putting an animal to court? If an animal, the Torah says that an animal is to die, kill it. An animal doesn't get any procedure, court procedure. Right? So he's saying it doesn't apply. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says, Mitatam be'esrim u'shlosha. No, their death is done by a court of 23. Just picture this in a way. According to the Mishnah, a court oversees the killing of an animal. In light of what we studied last year, I just want to point out, this may be not intuitive to us, but in a way, maybe it should be intuitive, that in fact you can't kill animals.
It's a sharp creature.
Correct. You cannot kill animals. And when we dealt with the killing of animals last year, remember, it was a highly ritualized procedure that made for the only way that it was permissible for a Jew to kill the animal. So that the law itself protects the animals. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. I don't think that we would have thought that. But here the law is protecting animals. Unless the animal be killed wantonly, the court has got to intervene even with the animal. Because it is a death penalty, and it is associated textually with a person. Right? In each case, it's associated with a person. And in the case in the book of Exodus, we had a problem in the text, and that problem was solved by associating with a person. I don't know what. I'm not saying it has to be that way, but that's the way they interpret it. Correct. Which is why Rabbi Eliezer says, Kol HaKodem Zocheh. The first person to kill is perfectly fine. The whole idea is bizarre. What we don't know is what Rabbi Akiva's position is here. Because we really have possibly either two or three positions. The first position is that you need a court of 23. Then comes Rabbi Eliezer's position. Then comes Rabbi Akiva. What we don't understand is he repeating the first position? Or is he somehow adding to the first position, and it's not the same as the first position? That the Gemara will discuss. Okay? I don't want to get to any of these things in detail, because that's why there's a Gemara. The Gemara will discuss these things. But it just, you see, we've gone to another area of the law. I want to go further. Hold your questions. Let's see if we can get... No, we're not going to get that far. So let's go to the questions.
Court of 23, if a show killed, the show Muad killed somebody, the family is supposed to get some reward. It doesn't discuss this penalty to the owner to pay the family that the man was killed.
Well, yes, it does. The Torah does. I mean, it doesn't here, because the carcass of the animal goes to the family.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it.
Even if the guy could produce a lot more than that?
Correct.
It's not a limited reward.
Correct.
Your comment about taking the life of the animals, we don't have a very developed law of hunting.
Of what?
Hunting.
Correct. Correct.
On food, we even think it's one of the reasons animals exist.
But the only way you can take their lives, again, it's a Jew. We're not saying this applies to everybody. But the only way the Jew can take the life of the animal that is permitted to him, and most animals are not permitted to him. Remember that one of the realities of the laws of kashrut is that most things you can't eat. It's just so different when you think of the Chinese, for example. When I was in China, I remember that I was having dinner on Shabbat with a guy who does is in the diamond business. From guy in the diamond business. So he says to me, Rabbi Wexler, he says, you don't really, he says, have you been by the Chinese restaurants in Hong Kong? And in fact, I did go by the Chinese restaurants in Hong Kong. I couldn't believe the smells. The worst smells I ever smelled in my whole life. Just terrible. I couldn't believe people could eat this food. It was just terrible. So he says to me, he says, I live in China. I spent half the month in China. He says, I can tell you one thing about the Chinese. If it moves, they either eat it or worship it. Or both. They either eat it or worship it. The Jews, it's the opposite. You can't worship any of them, and you can hardly eat any of them. You can't eat it. You can only eat a very limited number of animals. Given what's possible out there, it's next to nothing. Next to nothing. We're just so limited in what we're allowed to do. Did I ever tell you the story about Mary Douglas, the great anthropologist, great English anthropologist at the University of London? She gave a lecture once at the seminar. I was there. It was for the induction of Gershon Cohen, the chancellor of the seminar. She gave a brilliant lecture. And she explained the laws of kashrut. She says, why can't Jews eat lobsters? Why can't Jews eat lobsters? She says, well, lobsters taste good for every reason. She says, the reason Jews can't eat lobsters is that lobsters are, as she said, sitting ducks. Namely, lobsters are easy to capture. I can tell you that. I live in Maine. You just pick them up all the time. You put a little bit of bait in the trap, the lobsters, they're stupid. They're very dumb animals, and they just come and they walk in. So she says, God didn't want the Jews to eat from the bottom of the sea. The rest of the world eats from the bottom crawlers. The Jews are not allowed to eat from the bottom of the sea. The catfish they can't eat, the lobsters they can't eat, the crabs they can't eat. She says, these are the animals that can't really swim a lot. They can't run away. They are the vulnerable animals. This is a, I remember her saying that. Powerful, powerful notion. She says, the Jews cannot eat those things. It's an amazing idea here. That this is the anthropologist of our times analyzing the laws of kashrut. Incredible. So here you see most of this is off limits. And the animals have a very protected relation as far as the whole system goes.
I think the stoning is interesting, and I just asked this a question. In those cases, the animals are taking on human functions. They're interacting with humans in a way humans.
You mean the sexual realm?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So now, by virtue of doing that, it looks like they're taking on the protections associated with humans, and they're taking on the mechanisms of death.
Very interesting, yeah. It's crossing over, adjoining in the areas. You're right. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing you were just talking about as far as which animals you can eat and you can't eat. You could make the other argument that the ones that are more intelligent should be more preserved and not killed. And that the lower on the food chain, those are the ones that you should eat.
Mm-hmm. You could.
But that my other question is going back to this... what you were discussing in the beginning about a wrong decision and atoning for a wrong decision. But if you're constantly arguing about a decision, then when does it become a finite thing where it can be judged right?
Oh, that's a good question. When the high court makes its decision, at that point in time, you must abide by their decision, even if they're wrong. If you decide that they're wrong, let's say, it's just, it's wrong what they're doing. Because they have authority. That's the other side of it. One side is the quality of the argument. The other is the reality of the authority that they possess.
And are these decisions unanimous? Or
they don't have to be unanimous, no. They don't have to be unanimous. They don't have to be unanimous.
So then if there's a wrong decision and it's a death penalty, then what happens?
Well, it could be a serious case. We have the same problem. We continue to have that problem. And you will see...
But now we have forensics and things where you...
Well, one of the things that you'll see next time is that there is a certain lopsided procedure in the Court of 23. The Court of 23 is a very odd procedure. And we'll get to that next time. In 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Wasn't there the story about Hillel sitting in on the court and they use him as a precedent? And he said, that's not what I meant. It doesn't happen.
So, and the famous case